So, my delight,
Tuari.
So good to see you again. So, yeah. Tuari Sala has over 25 years of insight and Vipassana meditation experience. She's a guiding teacher at the Seattle Insight Meditation Society. Tuari believes that urban meditation is the foundation for today's practitioner's path to liberation. She's inspired by bringing the Dharma to non-traditional places and is a strong advocate for practitioners living with high stress, past trauma, and difficulties sitting still. That's no small task. Her teachings reflect an approach to Dharma that's both easy to follow and to understand, making it accessible to everyone. Tuari has completed extensive trainings, including a two-year Spirit Rock IMS Community Dharma Leader Program, a one-year Focusing for Complex Trauma course, which incorporates mindfulness principles within high stress. Mindfulness principles with somatic listening, so kind of listening to the body, I'm guessing. And also a mindfulness-based mind fitness training course, which incorporates mindfulness for high-stress work environments of first responders. So bringing the Dharma to some places where people really need it. So she has a long history of assisting others in establishing and maintaining a daily practice.
Good.
So thank you, Tuari, for being here, and it's my pleasure to hand it over to you.
Thank you, Metta. I have one question, one favor for you, Metta, before you sit down. For your managerial duties, I forgot my shawl upstairs. Can you run up there and get it for me? Yeah, it's up in the room, right there on the chair. Thank you. So, I am so glad to be here. I can't even tell you. We're going to talk a lot about suffering and the end of suffering. I mean, that's pretty much what practice is all about all the time. It's suffering and the end of suffering. So some of the stuff we're going to talk about, you've probably heard before. You would think, oh, I've already heard all that. I know all that. And you have to ask yourself, if you've heard that before and you know all that, how come you're still suffering? Right? So something in the Dhamma, every time we hear it, brings with it the possibility that we could hear something we have never heard before. In fact, when Buddha, when he actually, thank you so much, when he woke up, you know, he's by himself, there's nobody around, he don't have a teacher sitting there, when he woke up, what he said was that when he got this information, this understanding, this insight, what it was something that he had not heard before. So you're not looking for, when we sit together and we do these retreats, we're not looking for some sense of routine, that thing that I know so much. We're looking for something we don't know, something we haven't heard, something we are not familiar with. And in looking for that, then you might see something or hear something that you've not heard before. And when you hear that, that capacity is what gives us the ability to awaken. So we're going to try to see if together we can build enough samadhi in the room that we can begin to hear things in a different way, see things in a different way. And you begin to realize you might have the same problems, but if you change the way you look at them, then they become the thing that allows you to awaken. So I have some notes here. I have a schedule. I just want you to know I do have notes. I have a schedule. there's a way it's supposed to go. At first I was going to post the schedule, and then I thought, no, we might not want to post it. Because then you'll be looking at my schedule thinking, how come we're not doing that? So it's really just to help me keep honest. But so I have some semblance of a structure, and I don't get too lost. I'm a lawyer, ex-lawyer, I guess, and so we tend to talk a lot. So just sort of keep me in some kind of a flow. But I thought I would start with some opening comments to kind of set the place. You probably are used to sitting first and then talking in the Dhamma. But I don't know if you guys remember Venerable Panawati. She came here one time, and I think she might have came twice. But she helped me see that sometimes you should set the Dhamma first and then sit. So there's a direction in which we're looking, and not just start out by falling into routine. So I want to give you some comments just to help us see where I'm hoping the weekend will go. And then we'll have a sit. And each one of our sits, we're going to try to see if we can build upon our understanding around this material. So I want to start with finding out how many of you are familiar with the word samsara? Or I guess I should say, who's not familiar with the word samsara? All right, good. So samsara, it's a like a Pali word that we use, Sanskrit or Pali, I'm not sure which one of it is, but it really talks about this cycle of continuity that we live in. So one way to think about it is, think of the habits you have that you still have them, and you had them since you were, 15. There's a certain thing that you do. Like some people might be sarcastic. And then they've learned over the years, oh, that sarcasm can be a little harmful to people. I shouldn't be so sarcastic. But we still are, We can be, in our 70s. We're still sarcastic. That habit, that continuity all the time of flowing. Or it could be that you start work. You can remember when you started working, when you were 20, and you look up and 50, and you still, it's like your life has gone by, and you're just like going to work every day, same job, same thing, over and over and over. It's this continuity, this cyclical nature of the way that we live. And it's wrapped in this idea that things are not, they're not permanent, so they're always changing and always moving, but it is, we live in a world of delusion. We live in this world where we're constantly in motion, moving, going nowhere. And you don't always know that you're not going anywhere until you look back and say, wait, is the year is gone? It's been 10 years? I had all these plans of what I was going to do, and now it's been 10 years, and I didn't do any of them. So you don't know that you're stuck in this cyclical thing. But samsara is what we call that cyclical aspect of life. It's what comes from being part of and living in a conditioned world. And so over the weekend, we're going to break down how this kind of conditioning sets us up for difficulty. It's not visible, so we can't really see it. In fact, we don't even necessarily even feel it. That's why you can go your whole life, and it's only in retrospect do you know you were moving along. But it feels like when we're in it, we're just getting up every day, going to work, doing our thing, going to school, doing our life. And then when we look back, we're shocked at how much time has passed. It's this constant moving. And even though we can't see it, we can't really even feel it, it compels and pushes all of our behaviors. It pushes all of our actions, and it's pushing us all the time. It's sort of the motor behind our life. So it's pretty important, but we can't really see it. We are, engulfed in it, I guess. We're bound by it. A way to think about it is we're sort of like fish in water. And the fish would probably think, what do you mean water? What is that? We can see the water. And we can see that the fish need the water to live and how much the water contributes to the fish's life. But the fish can't see it. We can't see air. But we would know if there was no air here. We would know that we're losing air. So there's a something in it that we need, and we have to have it to survive. And yet, at the same time, we're always moved away from it. We're always pushed and compelled by it, and we don't see it. One way to begin to feel into it, just like if we took the air out of the space, we would know that it's not here. One way to kind of get a sense of knowing that samsara is here is to think about things like our preferences, good, bad, right, wrong, you know, what we like, what we don't like. All of those preferences is sort of like the molecules that make up air. It's like the H2O that make up water. And all of those preferences is what makes up samsara. So samsara moves by preferences. You could think of it that way. What pushes us in life is our preferences. And it pushes us through this kind of continuity of existence. I think I need to have a quote here. See if I can find it. Oh, here's it. So one way you could think about this, I like Trungpa Rinpoche. He says that we say that the sun is behind the clouds, but actually, it's not the sun, but the city from which we view it that is behind the clouds. If we realize that the sun is never behind the clouds, we might have a different attitude towards the whole thing. That's the difficulty with seeing samsara. Because we think we're seeing from the perspective of right, and that the delusion is out there. We don't realize that the delusion is in here, and that everything out there is much clearer. But we're looking at the world through deluded eyes. So this weekend, we want to try to see if we can see some of that delusion. When Buddha saw this delusion, he outlined it as three levels of suffering, and that's the nature of the three characteristics. So the first level of suffering, or the first kind of delusion that he saw, was this idea that we so hate change. We so hate it when things change. We want things to be steady and stable. I just want to know how it's going to go. How's it going to be? And that steady and stable helps us feel steady and stable. But we live in a world that's constantly changing. So that constant changing all the time, creating all this upheaval, he called that impermanence. That is a natural aspect of samsara. It's because it's always changing all the time. And then because it's always changing all the time, what we really live in is a world where conditions come together and conditions fall apart. Conditions come together and conditions fall apart. And that coming together, falling apart, and coming together and falling apart all the time. gives us this kind of dissatisfactory feeling. We're always a little off. I like the way the Tibetans call that. They call it this urge to correct. You know that feeling. When you see something, you just want, if I just tweak it just a little bit, then it'll be perfect. It's just not perfect now, but if I just a little bit. It's like looking at a picture that's just tilted just a little, and you just want to straighten it out. Once we get it straight, I'm going to feel okay. I don't know why I'm so, like, irritated about it, but if I get it straight, then we're going to be okay. And so we go about our lives constantly feeling that edge that something's wrong, but the sense that we have is if I tweak it just a little bit, it'll be okay. We don't realize that everything is always going to be a little off-center, that it is the nature of life to be a little off-center. It'll be center for a second, and then it's changing, and so it's going to be off-center again. So that suffering that comes with the fact that we live in a conditioned world, he called that dissatisfaction. And then he called the suffering that comes from physical pain this idea of non-self. And physical pain doesn't necessarily just mean, oh, my knee hurts or my back hurts or something like that. I have some illness. It also comes from the physical pain associated with disappointment or the physical pain that comes from sadness, losing something, a loss, defamed, somebody says something bad about us and we feel that physically in the body, or we want everybody to like us and we want everything to go good. So all of these kind of felt sense of unpleasantness, all of that, Buddha said, is subject. It's one of the reasons why we have all this suffering. So that idea is that we're going to break this down a little bit further over the weekend, but a basic understanding would be the fact that someone doesn't like you does not mean that you ever have to feel bad. I mean, they may feel bad because they don't like you, so they don't want to be around you, but you don't have to feel bad because they don't like you. But we don't live that way. If we find out someone is upset with us or doesn't like us, then we want to fix it so we feel better. It's that kind of constantly trying to, that felt sense of displeasure or unpleasantness that comes from not liking something we experience in the outside world. So that is a taking something personal that doesn't really have to be personal. That's what it is. Those three characteristics. That's what we're going to talk about. This weekend, we're going to talk about how these three characteristics bind us into suffering and how can mindfulness take us out of it. I went on the three-month retreat at IMS this past fall. And the first thing one of the teachers that I had, I don't know if you guys have ever sat with him, it's Bhante Buddharakitas, this guy from, monastic from Uganda. And he said, Tuere, I need you to tell me why Buddha stressed mindfulness. So why mindfulness? And I remember he asked me that the very first time we got together, and I'm thinking, I don't know. I mean, I don't know why he taught mindfulness. Is that what he taught, was mindfulness? I didn't even know that. I mean, I know we use mindfulness, but I didn't know he taught mindfulness. So I'm spending 3 months looking into why would Buddha teach mindfulness. And that mindfulness that is taught in the outer world as a secular thing That's not the mindfulness that Buddha was teaching. The mindfulness that we're going to talk about here over the weekend, it's a different kind of mindfulness. And that mindfulness, we got to, that's what we have to learn. And over the weekend, we'll talk about what it is I learned over this retreat on how to, why he would teach mindfulness. Given that he saw impermanence, that's what he saw. That was not the way the world was when he was walking around. When Buddha walked around, the world was a lot like the way our world is. In fact, his world was quite violent. He was telling somebody about the world he lived in, and some of the words he said, I can't remember the exact quote of it, but he described his world as death was so random that the human life didn't mean anything, that people kind of killed each other randomly. I read somewhere that the biggest safety that we have is that we can walk and meet each other, a stranger, and we don't have to think, do I have to kill this person? Do you see that? We don't think that. We walk down the street, we see a stranger, we're like, maybe you speak, maybe you don't. You don't care. You don't know them. You don't want to know them. You just walk right by. But there was a time in our existence that you couldn't just walk upon a stranger and not have to consider, do I have to fight this person? Because stranger was a big deal. You only lived in the world around the people you knew. And any stranger then who came upon you was someone to be feared. And so people killed each other randomly, much more so than we do now. So think about it. He lived in a world where there was, this is a hard life. This is not simple life. They didn't have no coffee makers. They didn't have these little, they didn't have electricity. I think about it every time I walk in my house. You have to teach yourself this, right? When you go home, don't turn on the lights. And see how much movement you can do around the house at night when there's no lights on. But people lived with a lot of inconveniences, a lot of inconveniences, a lot of danger. And what he talked about was not how to make your life better, but how to liberate your mind. Now, when we think about that, we're like, I got too much stuff to do. I can't be thinking about all the liberation of the mind stuff. That's like a luxury. But when he talked about it like we talk about electricity, like we talk about indoor plumbing. What he talked about was liberating your mind. And I'm kind of grateful for all those people, the thousands and thousands and millions of people that listen to the Buddha, because I think in some respects, a lot of our lack of fear that we have, a lot of our fear is made up fear in the mind. But a lot of that safety that we have today came because a lot of people listened to a lot of sacred beings over a lot of years. And over time, I think the human nervous system settled down a bit. So now, I can walk down the street, I see some stranger, I don't have to think, where's my sword? I need to pull it out. So this is sort of what we're going to talk about today, this week. And I want to see if I can help set the framework before we start this sit. For kind of like how to hold a non-residential. So how many of you go on a week-long or more retreat every single year? Okay, so look around the room. See the little scant hands up? That means most of us cannot do that. When I was working as a prosecutor, I could not take off a week to go on a retreat. So a few people in Sims would go on retreats, but I was not one of them. And they would talk about their retreats and talk about how they went on retreat and what they thought about a retreat. And I could not do that. So there's a sense that we feel like I can't really liberate the mind, or I can't really do this practice fully because I can't do a long retreat. And then I started noticing that SIMS offered non-residentials. They called them non-residential retreats. So I thought, oh, it's on a weekend. I could go. I don't have to miss work. I can go home at night. I could do that. So my first, I'd say the first probably 10 years with SIMS was all non-residential. Non-residential. I guess it was like, I went to my first retreat actually in 2005. So I started practicing with SIMS in 2001. So the first 5 years, that's all I did. Non-residential. And I learned something from this. When you start going on retreats, and if you make retreat your life, your serious practice, everything else is kind of routine, but the serious is to go on retreat. So when you come home to your life, because our lives are not set up in the conditioning of a retreat, many people I know who use retreat as their serious practice, they come home and they have to wait till they get to the next retreat because they can't take what they learned in the retreat and bring it home. But when you do a non-residential, life and retreat, life and practice are all mixed up together. So you can begin to learn how to take this practice and keep it with you at home. So that's what this is about. This is about not so much pulling away from life, but taking a moment to consider, how does my life fit in this retreat or fit in this practice? How does practice fit in my life? That's what we're going to work on all weekend. How to make it more seamless. And you can do that in a non-residential at a way that you cannot do it at a retreat, because your whole life is just a hair away from you. It's not like going away on a retreat far away. You got plenty of time to let go of your life. Here, your life is going to be with you in just a few hours. So we're going to see if we can hold the space. I'm going to give you some guided meditations through each of the meditations. We'll start with the guided, and then I'm not going to guide the whole thing, but I'm going to start with the guidance so we can turn together. And you can begin to feel how you can hold all of this in your own life. So even when I'm gone, you haven't lost. It wasn't, oh, I did that weekend, and that was great, but now everything's back to craziness. You know, try to see if we can, you can have that craziness and still feel steady on the inside. All right, so let's start with a sit. I want to read you a, get ourselves here. I'm going to read you a little poem to set the, set the energy here. It's from Donna Fouts. I love poetry. I hated it for most of my life. When I was in school, I hated the poetry section of English classes. And but now that my mind is, it just is not the same mind that I had when I was in high school. And so now, the idea of having to read poetry seems, how could you not live without poetry? It's so beautiful. And then I have probably the best poetry book in the world. And so I know you're going to want this book when I get done, because you won't believe the poetry that's in it. You won't be able to have this one, but I'll give you the name of it. It's the best poetry ever. So this poem by Donna Fouts is about what we need to put our mind right now, just for this sit. So she says, it is enough right now to taste one moment of peace. Of course, I want more, but at least the door is open. It is enough to draw a conscious breath and let my hands relax. Fingers releasing their tight grip on things outside of my control. It is enough to shed a layer of stress, as if taking off a jacket or a pair of too tight shoes. Ease of being has to start somewhere. This breath is my first step. So we're just going to start here. Just turning the mind towards being enough. Just this moment right here, right now. And one way to begin to see this moment, you could notice the sounds of how we settle. It's a beautiful sound to listen to practitioners settling into stillness. You can notice how things just get stiller and stiller and stiller. You're not actually doing anything to make it stiller. You're noticing that it's getting stiller. And then you might can notice that as your body moves less, you can notice that sounds have a moving quality to them, a coming and going. That even as the sounds end, they pick back up again. Can you notice that? Can you sense that there's a constant rhythm of sound moving, coming and going, that has nothing to do with you? You're just listening for that sound. You might even hear the sounds inside, like an internal sound, external sound. But we're sitting here relatively still, and there is the movement of this sound. We just want to take some time to notice that. Just noticing. Oh, it's enough. It's enough to just sit here and notice the coming and going of sound. Always this sound. It's quiet, then there's sound. It's soft sounds and harsh sounds. Sounds right up close, sounds kind of in the distance. You just notice that, just sitting here noticing how sounds come and go has nothing to do with me. Just keep listening for sounds. You're listening for the tiny sounds too, barely audible. You might even notice the silence in between sounds. I know the mind wants to think about other stuff. There's plenty of stuff going on in your life, in my life. You don't have to fight the mind. Just see if you can just get interested in the little symphony going on with sound. Let's see if you can get interested in the hearing and your capacity to just hear. Just see what that's like. So turn your attention away from all those thoughts and just listen. Open the ears and just take in sound. It's enough to just listen to sounds. Just stay with the sounds if you can. Plenty of time to get to the breath. See if you could just notice how random sound is. You're getting a sense of the movement of life. You're getting a first glance at how constant that movement is. Can you sense how constant impermanence is? It's always there. You know, it might feel like, oh my God, this is going to go on forever. This is quiet. There is a thread of stillness in the room here. But can you sense that there's still a lot of constant change, moving, sounds coming, going? Can you sense that constant moving? That undercurrent. Something within the silence. just hearing, nothing else. No effort. The ears do it without anything to do with you, just hearing. Just giving yourself permission to hear, just to be aware that hearing is happening. Short poem by David Boldbeer. Oh, this life, the now, this morning, which I can turn into forever by simply loving what is here. This life, the now, this morning, is gone by noon.